his sister that he had set his heart on killing the most dangerous animal in North America, the Rocky Mountain grizzly bear. He wanted to leave within 2 weeks, but extra ponies had to be found, and he was forced to postpone his departure to 18 August. In the interim, he roamed restlessly through the Badlands, riding 30 miles south to visit the Langs and 40 miles north to check up on my two backwoods babies. Exploring his new property with Sewell, he came upon the skulls of two elks with interlocked antlers. Theirs had been a duel to the death, he decided. It was just the sort of symbol to appeal to him, and he promptly named the ranch site Elkhorn. Apart from a touch of diarrhea brought on by the alkaline water of the Little Missouri, Sewell and Dow seemed to be adjusting well to Dakota and enjoying their new work. During the day, they worked at making Roosevelt's hunting shack habitable. It would serve as a home until the big ranch house was built, and at night took turns in watching the herd. Sewell still had misgivings about the Badlands as cattle country, while admitting that its wild, desolate grandeur has a kind of charm. Roosevelt used almost the same words in his letter to Bammy of 12 August. I grow very fond of this place, and it certainly has a desolate, grim beauty of its own that has a curious fascination for me. The grassy, scantily wooded bottoms through which the winding river flows are bounded by bare, jagged buttes. Their fantastic shapes and sharp, steep edges throw the most curious shadows under the cloudless, glaring sky, and at evening I love to sit out in front of the hut and see their hard, gray outlines gradually growing soft and purple as the flaming sunset by degrees softens and dies away. While my days I spend generally alone, riding through the lonely rolling prairie and broken lands. He spent whole days in the saddle, riding as many as 72 miles between dawn and darkness. Sometimes he rode on through the night, rejoicing in the way moonbeams play over the grassy stretches of the plateaus and glance off the wind-rippled blades as they would from water. His body hardened, the tan on his face deepened, hints of gold appeared in his hair and reddish mustache. I now look like a regular cowboy dandy, with all my equipments finished in the most expensive style, he wrote Bammy. His buckskin tunic, custom tailored by the widow Maddox, seamstress of the Badlands, gave him particular delight, although its resemblance to a lady's shirtwaist caused some comment in Medora. You would be amused to see me, he accurately wrote to Cabot Lodge, in my broad sombrero hat, fringed and beaded buckskin shirt, horsehide chaparajos or riding trousers, and cowhide boots with braided bridle and silver spurs. It was probably during these 17 free-ranging days that Roosevelt had his famous encounter with a bully in Nolan's Hotel, Mingusville, 35 miles west of Medora. The incident, which has since become a cliché in 1,000 Wild West yarns, is best told in his own words. I was out after lost horses. It was late in the evening when I reached the place. I heard one or two shots in the barroom as I came up, and I disliked going in. But there was nowhere else to go, and it was a cold night. Inside the room were several men who, including the bartender, were wearing the kind of smile worn by men who are making believe to like what they don't like. A shabby individual in a broad hat with a cocked gun in each hand was walking up and down the floor talking with strident profanity. He had evidently been shooting at the clock, which had two or three holes in its face. As soon as he saw me, he hailed me as Four Eyes, in reference to my spectacles, and said, Four Eyes is going to treat. I joined in the laugh and got behind the stove and sat down, thinking to escape notice. He followed me, however, and though I tried to pass it off as a jest, this merely made him more offensive, and he stood leaning over me, a gun in each hand, using very foul language. In response to his reiterated command that I should set up the drinks, I said, Well, if I've got to, I've got to, and rose looking past him. As I rose, I struck quick and hard with my right, just to one side of the point of his jaw, hitting with my left as I straightened out, and then again with my right. He fired the guns, but I do not know whether this was merely a convulsive action of his hands, or whether he was trying to shoot at me. When he went down, he struck the corner of the bar with his head. If he had moved, I was about to drop on my knees, but he was senseless. I took away his guns, and the other people in the room, who were now loud in their denunciation of him, hustled him out and put him in the shed. Next morning, Roosevelt heard to his satisfaction that the bully had left town on a freight train. Another threat, from a more powerful adversary, arrived at Elkhorn one day in the form of a letter from the Marquis de Moray. it coolly announced that Roosevelt had no title to the land around his ranch site. In the summer of 1883, the Marquis had stocked it with 12,000 sheep, therefore the range belonged to him. Like most Americans, Roosevelt had a profound contempt for sheep. Not only did the bleating idiots nibble the grass so short that they starved out cattle, they were, intellectually speaking, about the lowest level of brute creation. "No man can associate with sheep," he snorted, "and retain his self-respect." In any case, the Marquis's flock had not survived the winter. Roosevelt curtly informed de Moray, by return messenger, that only dead sheep remained on the range, and he did not think that they would hold it. There was no reply, but Sewell and Dow were warned to look out for trouble. One melancholy duty awaited Roosevelt before he set off for the Bighorns on 18 August. The collation of some tributes, speeches, and newspaper clippings into a printed memorial for Alice Lee. Having arranged them as best he could, he added his own poignant superscription under the heading, "In Memory of My Darling Wife." "She was beautiful in face and form, and lovelier still in spirit. As a flower she grew, and as a fair young flower she died. Her life had always been in the sunshine. There had never come to her a single great sorrow, and none ever knew her who did not love and revere her for her bright, sunny temper and her saintly unselfishness. Fair, pure, and joyous as a maiden, loving, tender, and happy as a young wife, when she had just become a mother, when her life seemed to be but just begun, and when the years seemed so bright before her, then, by a strange and terrible fate, death came to her. And when my heart's dearest died, the light went from my life forever." The manuscript was sent to New York for private publication and distribution. Roosevelt sank briefly back into total despair. Gazing across the burned-out landscape of the Badlands, he told Bill Sewell that all his hopes lay buried in the East. He had nothing to live for, he said, and his daughter would never know him. "She would be just as well off without me." Talking as to a child, Sewell assured him that he would recover. "You won't always feel as you do now, and you won't always be willing to stay here and drive cattle." But Roosevelt was inconsolable. A month later, his mood had improved considerably. "I have had good sport," he wrote Bammy on descending from the Bighorn Mountains, "and enough excitement and fatigue to prevent overmuch thought." He added significantly, "I have at least been able to sleep well at night." Readers of Roosevelt's Diary of the Hunt might wonder if by excitement he did not mean carnage. A list culled from the pages of this little book indicates just how much blood was needed to blot out thought. Since Alice's death, his diaries had become a monotonous record of things slain. 17 August. "My battery consists of a long 45 caliber Colt revolver, 150 cartridges, a number 10 choke bore, 300 cartridge shotgun, a 45-75 Winchester repeater with 1,000 cartridges, a 40-90 Sharps, 150 cartridges, a 50-150 double-barreled Webley Express, 100 cartridges. 19 August. 4 grouse, 5 duck. 20 August. 1 whitetail buck, still in velvet, 2 sage hens. 24 August. Knocked the heads off 2 sage grouse. 25 August. 6 sharp-tailed grouse, 2 doves, 2 teal. 26 August. 8 prairie chickens. 27 August. 12 sage hens and prairie chickens, 1 yearling whitetail through the heart. 29 August. Broke the backs of 2 black-tailed bucks with a single bullet. 31 August. 1 jackrabbit, cutting him nearly in two. 3 September. 2 blue grouse. 4 September. 2 elk. 5 September. 1 red rabbit, 1 blue grouse. 7 September. 2 elk, 1 black-tailed doe. 8 September. Spares a doe and 2 fawns, as we have more than enough meat. Kills 12 grouse instead. 11 September. 50 trout. 12 September. 1 bull elk, killing him very neatly, knocked the heads off 2 grouse. 13 September. 1 black-tailed buck through the shoulder, 1 grizzly bear through the brain. 14 September. 1 black-tailed buck, 1 female grizzly, 1 bear cub, the ball going clean through him from end to end. 15 September. 4 blue grouse. 16 September. 1 bull elk, broke his back. 17 September. Broke camp. 3 pack ponies laden with hides and horns. Heading back to Dakota with his stinking cargo, Roosevelt killed a further 40 birds and animals on the prairie, making his total bag 170 items in just 47 days. So much for excitement. As to fatigue, he punished himself more severely during these 7 weeks than ever before in his life. He covered nearly 1,000 miles in the saddle and on foot, scorning a prairie schooner which accompanied him most of the way. The weather was often brutal, with winds powerful enough to overturn the wagon and huge hailstones thudding into the earth with the velocity of bullets. But Roosevelt seemed to glory in it, once riding off alone into the rain. He camped in the Bighorns at altitudes of well over 8,000 feet and at temperatures of well below freezing. Yet for all the thin air in his lungs and the chill in his bones, he pursued elk and bear with the energy of a hardened mountain man. "We had been running briskly after elk uphill through the soft, heavy loam, in which our feet made no noise but slipped and sank deeply. As a consequence, I was all out of breath and my hand so unsteady that I missed my first shot. I doubt if I ever went through more violent exertion than in the next 10 minutes. We raced after them at full speed, opening fire. I wounded all three, but none of the wounds were immediately disabling. They trotted on, and we panted afterward, slipping on the wet earth, pitching headlong over charred stumps, leaping on dead logs that broke beneath our weight, more than once measuring our full length across the ground, halting and firing whenever we got a chance. At last, one bull fell. We passed him by after the others, which were still running uphill. The sweat streamed into my eyes and made furrows in the sooty mud that covered my face from having fallen full length down the burnt earth. I sobbed for breath as I toiled at a shambling trot after them, as nearly done out as could well be. He kept on going until he had killed the second elk, and pursued the third until the blood grew less and ceased, and I lost the track. Assuredly, all this activity left Roosevelt little time to brood. Yet there was at least one final throb of grief. One night in the Bighorns, as bull elks trumpeted their wild, silvery mating calls, he blurted out to Merrifield the details of his wife's death. He said that his pain was beyond any healing. When Merrifield, who was also a widower, mumbled the conventional response, Roosevelt interjected, "Now don't talk to me about time will make a difference. Time will never change me in that respect." On 13 September, a 9-foot, 1,200-pound grizzly reared up not 8 paces in front of him. "Doubtless my face was pretty white, but the blue barrel was as steady as a rock as I glanced along it until I could see the top of the bead fairly between his 2 sinister-looking eyes. As I pulled the trigger, I jumped aside out of the smoke to be ready if he charged, but it was needless, for the great brute was struggling in the death agony. The bullet hole in his skull was as exactly between his eyes as if I had measured the distance with a carpenter's rule." Feeling calm and purged, Roosevelt suddenly decided he would, after all, go back east to vote. He might even take part in the last few weeks of the campaign and make a speech or two for Henry Cabot Lodge. In a letter to Bammy, written at Fort McKinney, Wyoming, on 20 September, he gave his first hint of paternal yearning for baby Lee. "I hope Mousikins will be very cunning. I shall dearly love her." Impatience began to gather as the expedition creaked slowly homeward over 300 miles of barren prairie. On 4 October, with 75 miles still to go, Roosevelt could stand the pace no longer. Leaving the wagon and extra ponies in care of his driver, he and Merrifield rode the remaining distance non-stop by night. He allowed himself just 1 day to recover, having been in the saddle almost continuously for 24 hours, before riding another 40 miles north to visit Sewell and Dow. They had unpleasant news for him. His forebodings of trouble after rejecting the Marquis's claim to the Elkhorn Range had been justified. E.G. Paddock, now more and more the power behind the throne of Dumouriez, had stopped by the ranch side in late September, accompanied by several drunken gunmen. Finding Roosevelt away, the gang accepted lunch, sobered up, and rode off well stoked with beans and bonhomie. Since then, however, Paddock had begun to declare that the Elkhorn shack was rightfully his. If Four Eyes wished to buy it, he must pay for it in dollars, or in blood. Roosevelt, on hearing this, merely said, "Is that so?" Remounting his horse, he rode back upriver to Paddock's house at the railroad crossing. The gunman answered his knock. "I understand that you have threatened to kill me on sight," rasped Roosevelt. I have come over to see when you want to begin the killing. Paddock was so taken aback, he could only protest that he had been misquoted. Next morning, Roosevelt left for New York, confident that from now on his ranch site would be left in peace. On 11 October, a Sun reporter found the former assemblyman pacing restless and ruddy-faced around the library of 422 Madison Avenue, a glass of sherry in his hand, anxious to discuss campaign politics. "It is altogether contrary to my character," Roosevelt explained, with the frankness that endeared him to all newspaper men, "to occupy a neutral position in so important and so exciting a struggle." He added rather wistfully that it was duty, not ambition, that brought him back east. "I myself am not a candidate for any office whatsoever, for the present at least." The reporter pressed for a comment on Grover Cleveland and elicited the following exchange, in which Roosevelt's moral disdain for the governor shone clear. Question: what do you think of Mr. Cleveland as a candidate for President of the United States? Answer: I think that he is not a man who should be put in that office, and there is no lack of reasons for it. His public career, in the first place, and then private reasons as well. Of these personal questions I will not speak unless forced to, as Mr. Cleveland has always treated me with the utmost courtesy. But if, as I said, it should become necessary for me to discuss personal objections. During his 7 subsequent campaign speeches, delivered between 14 October and 3 November, mainly in New York and in Lodge's Massachusetts constituency, Roosevelt avoided the ugly accusations of debauchery which Republicans everywhere were flinging at Cleveland. Respect for that decent gentleman still lurked within him. He managed, however, to make at least one sanctimonious reference to the immorality of breaking the 7th commandment. Innuendo of this sort, from a man as genuinely puritanical as Roosevelt, might have been acceptable had it not been flavored with hypocrisy. Cleveland's sexual peccadillo signified little in national opinion. The governor had made no attempt to hide the details, and the scandal had begun to die down. On the other hand, Blaine Sims, as a speaker who had used the powers of office to promote his own portfolio, could not be easily forgotten. There was no question as to which candidate was the morally inferior. Roosevelt's statement that he was a Republican and therefore bound to support Blaine was understandable. Yet it could have been made in a letter from Dakota, rather than repeated ad nauseam all over the East on platforms festooned with portraits of a man he despised. In later years, Roosevelt's support of the plumed knight proved to be something of an embarrassment to his admirers, including that most ardent of them, himself. Nobody has ever satisfactorily reconciled Roosevelt's passionate antagonism to Blaine in May and June with his equally passionate partisanship in October and November, although it has been argued that in bowing to the will of the party, he was simply acting as a complete political professional. His many statements of support and non-support, his promises of action and threats of inaction, were bewilderingly self-contradictory. No adulterer could more adroitly combine illicit lovemaking with matrimonial obligations than Roosevelt in his relations with both wings of the party in 1884. While seducing the independents, he promised to remain faithful to the stalwarts. After abandoning the former, he assured them it was not out of love for the latter. In his defense, it must be said that he never sounded insincere. He genuinely believed that an Edmunds might represent the good in politics, but that only a Blaine, as president, could effectively bring that good about. Still, it is hard to avoid the conclusion of one disgusted classmate. The great good, of course, was Teddy. On 20 October, Roosevelt was annoyed to read a report by one Horace White of his off-the-record post-convention remarks in a Chicago hotel 5 months before. White, it turned out, was the journalist to whom he had blustered late on the night of Blaine's nomination that any proper Democratic nomination will have our hearty support. In an obvious attempt to expose Roosevelt as a turncoat, White chose to report the interview now, when the ex-assemblyman was back in the public eye. To make the blow more personal, he did so in the correspondence columns of the New York Times. Roosevelt could do little but protest in a letter of reply that, "I was savagely indignant at our defeat, and so expressed myself in private conversation." He had positively refused to say anything for publication, nor did I use the words that Mr. White attributes to me. But the damage to his reputation had been done. He consoled himself in Boston with the society of such intellectuals as William Dean Howells, Thomas Bailey Aldrich, and Oliver Wendell Holmes. These men came to a dinner at Lodge's in honor of Roosevelt's 26th birthday, and he glowed in the radiance of their conversation. "I do not know when I have enjoyed a dinner so much." As the campaign entered its final week, Blaine seemed poised for inevitable victory. His extraordinary personal magnetism had never been stronger. Audiences everywhere serenaded him with adoring courses of "We'll follow where the white plume waves." The stolid Cleveland, meanwhile, droned on about the tariff and civil service reform, trying to ignore catcalls of, "Ma, ma, where's my pa? Gone to the White House, ha, ha, ha." Then in New York on 29 October, a garrulous Presbyterian minister, with Blaine standing at his side, publicly accused the Democratic Party of representing rum, Romanism, and rebellion. The candidate, who was only half listening, did not react to this faux pas, and therefore seemed to condone it. An alert bystander reported the phrase to Cleveland headquarters, just one block away. Within hours, it had been telegraphed to every Democratic newspaper in the country. Headlines and handbills amplified the insult a millionfold. Overnight, Blaine's support among anti-prohibitionists, Catholics, and Southerners shrank away. In New York alone, he lost an estimated 50,000 votes. On Election Day, 4 November, Grover Cleveland became the nation's first Democratic president in a quarter of a century. In a letter of condolence to Henry Cabot Lodge, whose bid for Congress had received a humiliating rejection in the polls, Roosevelt raged against the cursed pharisaical fools and knaves who have betrayed us. Evidently, he ascribed the Republican defeat to independent defectors, although every other political commentator in the country blamed it on the Presbyterian minister. The fact that he and Lodge had helped muster the independents at Chicago, only to fall in behind the regular Republicans later, did not seem to indicate any betrayal on their part. But 3 days after this letter to Lodge, he wrote a mea culpa, which shows that all his essential decency and common sense had returned, if not yet his optimism. "Of course it may be true that we have had our day. It is far more likely that this is true in my case than yours. Blaine's nomination meant to me pretty sure political death if I supported him. That I realized entirely and went in with my eyes open. I have won again and again. Finally, chance placed me where I was sure to lose whatever I did. And I will balance the last against the first. I shall certainly not complain. I have not believed and do not believe that I shall ever be likely to come back into political life. We fought a good winning fight when our friends the independents were backing us. And we have both of us, when circumstances turned them against us, fought the losing fight grimly out to the end. What we have been cannot be taken away from us. What we are is due to the folly of others, and to no fault of ours." In larger retrospect, it may be seen that Roosevelt had done exactly the right thing, obeying the dictates of a political instinct so profound as to be almost infallible. He did not realize his luck as he miserably returned to Dakota, but a Republican victory might have destroyed his chances of ever becoming president. The grateful Blaine would have offered him a government post, along with all the machine men who supervised the campaign. Roosevelt would thereafter have been associated with the corrupt old guard of the 19th century, rather than the enlightened progressives of the 20th. His decision not to bolt after Chicago was equally fortunate. Cleveland would not likely have rewarded him, and later Republican conventions would remember him as a man of doubtful loyalty. All in all, a Republican defeat was the best thing that could have happened to Roosevelt in 1884. The fact that three alliterative words brought about that defeat only reinforces the conclusion that fate, as usual, was on his side. Not that he could be persuaded to see it that way. "The statesman of the past," he wrote Lodge from Maltese Cross, "has been merged, alas I fear for good, in the cowboy of the present." On 16 November, a spell of white weather settled down over the Badlands as Roosevelt left his southern ranch and headed north to Elkhorn. His progress was slow that morning, for he had a beef herd to deliver to Medora. It was almost 2 o'clock before he concluded his business in town and rode on alone, with 33 miles to go. The wind in his face was achingly cold, especially on exposed plateaus when it combed grains of snow out of the grass and hurled them at him. The sensation was not unlike being whipped with sandpaper. His lungs, still occasionally troubled by asthma, gasped with every frigid breath, and his eyes throbbed in the glare of the sun. Descent into sheltered bottoms afforded some relief, but he took his life in his hands whenever he rode across the river. the ice was not yet solid. Should Manitou break through and douse him, it would be a serious matter, for a wedding in such weather, with a long horseback journey to make, is no joke. Darkness surprised him when he was scarcely halfway to his destination. For a while he cantered along in the starlight, listening to the muffled drumming of his horse's hooves, and the long-drawn melancholy howling of a wolf a quarter of a mile off. Clouds soon reduced visibility to zero, and he was forced to seek shelter in an empty shack by the river. There was enough wood round about to build a roaring fire, but no food to cook. All he had was a paper of tea leaves and some salt. I should have liked something to eat, but as I did not have it, the tea did not prove such a bad substitute for a cold and tired man. At dawn, Roosevelt woke to the hoarse clucking of hundreds of prairie fowl. Sallying forth with his rifle, he shot 5 sharptails. It was not long before 2 of the birds, plucked and cleaned, were split open and roasted before the fire, and to me they seemed most delicious food. Exactly 1 month before, he had been campaigning on the platform of Chickering Hall in New York, twisting his eyeglasses, catching bouquets, and blushing under the admiring gaze of bejeweled society matrons. Sewell and Dow were felling trees for the ranch house when he galloped down into the Elkhorn Bottom a few hours later. He seized an axe to assist them, much to their secret amusement, for Roosevelt was no lumberman. At the end of that day, he was chagrined to overhear Dow report to a cowpuncher, "Well, Bill cut down 53, I cut 49, and the boss, he beavered down 17. "Those who have seen the stump of a tree which has been gnawed down by a beaver," Roosevelt commented wryly, "will understand the exact force of the comparison." The cold worsened as they started to erect the walls of the house. For 2 weeks, temperatures hovered around -10 degrees Fahrenheit, plummeting at night to 50 degrees below zero. Trees cracked and jarred from the strain of the frost, and the wheels of the ranch wagon sang on the marble-hard ground. Roosevelt's cattle huddled for warmth, with saddles of powdered snow lying across their backs and icicles hanging from their lips. He wondered that they did not die. At night, the stars seemed to snap and glitter. Coyotes howled with weird ventriloquial effects, and white owls hovered in the dark like snow wreaths. Tactfully dissuaded from helping Sewell and Dow with construction, Roosevelt returned to Maltese Cross and tried to write the book he had been meditating upon all summer. But he was too cold or too restless to do more than a few thousand words. He read poetry, roamed the slippery slopes in pursuit of bighorn sheep, broke ponies, lunched at Chateau de Moray with the Marquis, and, ever the politician, campaigned up and down the valley to organize a Little Missouri Stockmen's Association. On one such trip, he managed to freeze his face, 1 foot, both knees, and 1 hand. Despite all this activity, there were periods of depression, stimulated by the bleakness of the weather, which seemed so symbolic of the bleakness in his own life. He sensed a relationship between the iron in his soul and the iron in the landscape. The texture of the frozen soil, its ringing sound effects, the blue metallic sheen of the Little Missouri, are images which recur obsessively in his writings about Dakota, with constant repetitions of the word iron, iron, iron. All these elements synthesized in one magnificent prose poem entitled simply, Winter Weather. When the days have dwindled to their shortest, and the nights seem never-ending, then all the great northern plains are changed into an abode of iron desolation. Sometimes furious gales blow down from the north, driving before them the clouds of blinding snow dust, wrapping the mantle of death round every unsheltered being that faces their unshackled anger. They roar in a thunderous bass as they sweep across the prairie or whirl through the naked canyons. They shiver the great brittle cottonwoods, and beneath their rough touch, the icy limbs of the pines that cluster in the gorges sing like the chords of an Aeolian harp. Again, in the coldest midwinter weather, not a breath of wind may stir. And then the still, merciless, terrible cold that broods over the earth like the shadow of silent death seems even more dreadful in its gloomy rigor than is the lawless madness of the storms. All the land is like granite. The great rivers stand still in their beds, as if turned to frosted steel. In the long nights there is no sound to break the lifeless silence. Under the ceaseless, shifting play of the northern lights, or lighted only by the wintry brilliance of the stars, the snow-clad plains stretch out into dead and endless wastes of glimmering white. With the new year and spring, and the return of the meadowlark to Dakota, his blood would begin to run warm again. Chapter 12. The Four-Eyed Maverick. Then said Olaf, laughing, "Not 10 yoke of oxen have the power to draw us like a woman's hair." The ha-ha-honk, ha-honk of wild geese grew louder in his ears. With unfocused eyes, he watched the V-shaped skein flying low and heavily overhead and settling about a mile upriver. Then he hunched again over Bammy's desk and scrawled in his large schoolboyish hand, "I took the rifle instead of a shotgun and hurried after them on foot." Roosevelt had learned that January of 1885, the old truism that writers write best when removed from the scene they are describing. At Elkhorn and Maltese Cross, he had been too much a part of his environment to recreate it on paper. Fleeing the reality of Dakota just before Christmas, he began to write almost immediately after arriving in New York. During the first 9 weeks of the new year, nearly 100,000 words poured from his pen. By 8 March, Hunting Trips of a Ranchman was finished. "I have just sent my last roll of manuscript to the printer," he told Cabot Lodge. While modest about the quality of his prose, Roosevelt declared that the pictures will be excellent. It is not known whether by this he meant the book's illustrations or a series of publicity photographs of himself in the full glory of his buckskin suit. One of these was chosen as frontispiece and caused much hilarity when Hunting Trips came out. Bristling with cartridges, a silver dagger in his belt, Roosevelt stands with Winchester at the ready against a studio backdrop of flowers and ferns. His moccasins are firmly planted on a mat of artificial grass. For some reason, his spectacles have been allowed to dangle. Although his finger is on the trigger, one doubts if he could so much as hit the photographer, let alone a distant grizzly. His expression combines pugnacity, intelligence, and a certain adolescent vulnerability which touched Lodge, at least, very tenderly. Hunting Trips was published by G.P. Putnam's Sons early in July and dedicated to that keenest of sportsmen and truest of friends, my brother Elliot Roosevelt. The first edition, limited to 500 copies, set new standards of lavishness in Americana. It was printed on quarto-sized sheets of thick, creamy, hand-woven paper with 2.5-inch margins and sumptuous engravings. Bound in gray, gold-lettered canvas, it retailed at the then unheard-of price of $15 and quickly became a collector's item. The book was well reviewed on both sides of the Atlantic. The British Spectator said it could claim an honorable place on the same shelf as Waterton's Wanderings and Walton's Complete Angler, went through several editions, and was soon accepted as a standard textbook of big game hunting in the United States. Roosevelt's first published work had also achieved textbook status, yet few critics could have guessed, without comparing title pages, that the same man had written both. Where the Naval War of 1812 had been scholarly, dry, crammed with sterile statistics, Hunting Trips was lyrical, lush, and cheerfully rambling. It shows signs of being too hastily written. Anecdotes are repeated 3 times over. Purplish tinges mar the otherwise crystal prose. Thrilling chapters end in anticlimax. There are examples of Roosevelt's perennial tendency to praise himself with faint dams. Some zoological details are inaccurate, betraying the fact that the author had, after all, lived only a few parts of 1 year in Dakota. He is at pains, however, to give the impression that he is a leathery pioneer of many years' standing. Less than half the text is about hunting as such. Although Roosevelt tells, with tremendous pace and gusto, the story of all his major expeditions, some of the best pages are those in which he muses on the beauty of the Badlands, the simple pleasures of ranch life, the joy of being young and free on the frontier. Except for an occasional outpouring of melancholy adjectives, he gives no indication that he was a broken-hearted man during most of these adventures. On the contrary, there is an abundance of lusty, sensuous images. The carpet-like softness of prairie roses under his horse's hooves, the smell of bear's blood on his hands, the taste of jerked beef after a mouthful of snow, and, most memorably, the warm freshness of a deer's bed, with its blades of grass still slowly rising after the hasty departure of the weight that has flattened them down. Roosevelt's characteristic auditory effects resonate on every page. From the wild, not unmusical calls of cowboys on night herd duty, their voices half-mellowed by the distance, to the harsh grating noise of a dying elk's teeth gnashing in agony. There are, to be sure, some vignettes that make non-hunters gag, such as that of a wounded black-tailed buck galloping along with a portion of his entrails sticking out and frozen solid. But the overwhelming impression left after reading Hunting Trips of a Ranchman is that of love for and identity with all living things. Roosevelt demonstrates an almost poetic ability to feel a bighorn's delight in its sinewy nimbleness, the sluggish timidity of a rattlesnake, the cool air on an unsaddled horse's back, the numb stiffness of a hail-bruised antelope. How such a lover of animals could kill so many of them, at the time of writing his lifetime tally was already well into the thousands, is a perhaps unanswerable question. But his bloodthirstiness, if it can be called that, was not unusual among men of his class and generation. Roosevelt hunted according to a strict code of personal morality. He had nothing but contempt for the swinish game butchers who hunt for hides and not for sport or actual food, and who murder the gravid doe and the spotted fawn with as little hesitation as they would kill a buck of 10 points. No one who is not himself a sportsman and lover of nature can realize the intense indignation with which a true hunter sees these butchers at their brutal work of slaughtering the game, in season and out, for the sake of the few dollars they are too lazy to earn in any other and more honest way. Roosevelt's arduous spell of writing in the early months of 1885 left him physically and emotionally drained. As usual, when he was reduced to this condition, the cholera morbus struck, delaying his scheduled departure for Dakota from 22 March to 14 April. Even then he looked so pale and dyspeptic above his high white collar that Douglas Robinson wrote ahead to Bill Sewell saying that his sisters were worried about him and asking for reports of his health. If Sewell was conscientious enough to obey, he would have replied that Roosevelt seemed determined to contract pneumonia after arriving back in Medora. Although the weather was still wintry, the Little Missouri was swollen with dirty thaw water from upcountry. The only way to cross it was to ride between the tracks of the railroad trestles, unless one chose, like Roosevelt, to negotiate the submerged, slippery top of a dam farther downstream. "If Manitou gets his feet on that dam, he'll keep them there, and we can make it finally," he told Joe Ferris. But halfway across, Manitou overbalanced, and to the horror of spectators, horse and rider disappeared into the hurtling river. When they surfaced a few moments later, Roosevelt was seen swimming beside Manitou, pushing ice blocks out of the horse's way, and splashing water in his face to guide him. They made the shore just in time to avoid being swept away completely. The next landing was more than a mile north. Roosevelt actually enjoyed the experience. A few days later, he again swam across the river with Manitou, at a point where there were no spectators to rescue him. "I had to strike my own line for 20 miles over broken country before I reached home and could dry myself," he boasted to Bammy. "However, it all makes me feel very healthy and strong." The Elkhorn Ranch was now complete. Roosevelt, exploring its 8 spacious rooms, found that they measured up in every way to the descriptions he had already written of them. Bearskins and buffalo robes strewed the beds and couches. A perpetual fire of cottonwood logs reddened the hearthstone. Stuffed heads cast monstrous shadows across the rough log walls. There were rifles in every corner, coonskin coats and beaver caps hanging from the rafters. Sturdy shelves groaned with the collected works of Irving, Hawthorne, Cooper, and Lowell, as well as his favorite light reading, Dreamy Ike Marvel, Burroughs's Breezy Pages, and the quaint, pathetic character sketches of the Southern writers, Cable, Craddock, Macon, Joel Chandler Harris, and Sweet Sherwood Bonner. It was still too cold to sit out in his rocking chair. What true American does not enjoy a rocking chair? But he looked forward to many summer afternoons on the piazza, reading or just simply contemplating the view. "When one is in the Badlands, he feels as if they somehow look just exactly as Poe's tales and poems sound." He was pleased to see that his cattle had apparently survived the harsh winter well. "Bill, you were mistaken about those cows. Cows and calves are all looking fine." Nothing could shake Sewell's habitual pessimism. "You wait until next spring and see how they look." Unfazed, Roosevelt sent Sewell and Dow to Minnesota, along with Sylvain Ferris, to help Merrifield bring back an extra 1,500 head. This latest purchase, amounting to $39,000, raised his total investment in the Badlands to $85,000, virtually half his patrimony. Coming on top of the $45,000 he had already spent at Leholm, it made Roosevelt's family as nervous about his finances as about his health. Bami asked for guarantees that the cattle venture would pay, but got only the unconvincing reply, "I honestly think that it will." The new herd arrived in Medora on 5 May, and the bulk of it came north to Elkhorn under Roosevelt's personal supervision. Never before had he attempted to manage so many cattle, and the experience nearly killed him. Since the river was still dangerously high, he was forced to stay clear of the valley and trek inland. On the third day out, the cattle had no water at all. That night, they bedded down obediently. But an hour or two later, when Roosevelt and a cowboy were standing guard, 1,000 thirst-maddened animals suddenly heaved to their feet and stampeded. "The only salvation was to keep them close together, as if they once got scattered, we knew they could never be gathered. So I kept on one side and the cowboy on the other, and never in my life did I ride so hard. In the darkness I could but dimly see the shadowy outlines of the herd, as with whip and spurs I ran the pony along its edge, turning back the beasts at one point, barely in time to wheel and keep them in at another. The ground was cut up by numerous little gullies, and each of us got several falls, horses and riders turning complete somersaults. We were dripping with sweat, and our ponies quivering and trembling like quaking aspens, when, after more than an hour of the most violent exertion, we finally got the herd quieted again." Pale and pathetically thin, Theodore Roosevelt arrived at Box Elder Creek on 19 May to assist in the Badlands Spring Roundup. "You could have spanned his waist with your two thumbs and fingers," a colleague remembered. The cowboys looked askance at his toothbrush and razor and scrupulously neat bedroll. There were the usual jibes about his glasses, which he submitted to with resigned dignity. "When I went among strangers, I always had to spend 24 hours in living down the fact that I wore spectacles, remaining as long as I could judiciously deaf to any side remarks about four eyes, unless it became evident that my being quiet was misconstrued and that it was better to bring matters to a head at once." He did not need to knock a man down during the next 4 weeks to win the respect of the cowboys, although there was one occasion when he told a Texan who addressed him as Storm Windows to put up or shut up. It soon became apparent that Roosevelt could ride 100 miles a day, stay up all night on watch, and be back at work after a hastily gulped 3 a.m. breakfast. On one occasion, he was in the saddle for nearly 40 hours, wearing out 5 horses and winding up in another stampede. He roped steers till his hands were flayed, wrestled calves in burning clouds of alkali dust, and stuck like a burr to bucking ponies while his nose poured blood and hat, guns, and spectacles flew in all directions. One particularly vicious horse fell over backward on him, cracking the point of his left shoulder. There was no doctor within 100 miles, so he continued to work, as best I could, until the injury healed of itself. It was weeks before he could raise his arm freely. "That four-eyed maverick," remarked one veteran puncher, "has sand in his craw plenty." The roundup ranged down the Little Missouri Valley for 200 miles, fanning out east and west at least half as far again. During the 5 weeks that it lasted, 60 men riding 300 horses coaxed some 4,000 cattle out of the myriad creeks, coulees, basins, ravines, and gorges of the Badlands, sorting them into proprietary herds and branding every calf with the mark of its mother. When Roosevelt withdrew from the action on 20 June, he had been with the roundup for 32 days, longer than most cowboys, and had ridden nearly 1,000 miles. "It is certainly a most healthy life," he exulted. "How a man does sleep, and how he enjoys the coarse fare." Some extraordinary physical and spiritual transformation occurred during this arduous period. It was as if his adolescent battle for health, and his more recent but equally intense battle against despair, were crowned with sudden victory. The anemic, high-pitched youth who had left New York only 5 weeks before was now able to return to it, rugged, bronzed, and in the prime of health, to quote a newspaperman who met him en route. His manner, too, had changed. There was very little of the whilom dude in his rough and easy costume, with a large handkerchief tied loosely about his neck. The slow, exasperating drawl and the unique accent that the New Yorker feels he must use when visiting a less blessed portion of civilization had disappeared, and in their place is a nervous, energetic manner of talking with the flat accent of the West. In New York, another reporter was struck by his sturdy walk and firm bearing. Roosevelt's own habitual assertion that he felt as brown and tough as a hickory knot at last carried conviction. All references to asthma and cholera morbus disappear from his correspondence. He was now, in the words of Bill Sewell, as husky as almost any man I have ever seen who wasn't dependent on his arms for his livelihood. Throughout that summer, Roosevelt continued to swell with muscle, health, and vigor. William Roscoe Thayer, who had not seen him for several years, was astonished to find him with the neck of a titan and with broad shoulders and stalwart chest. Thayer prophesied that this magnificent specimen of manhood would have to spend the rest of his life struggling to reconcile the conflicting demands of a powerful mind and an equally powerful body. Summer was but 5 days old, and the sea breeze blew cool as Roosevelt's carriage circled Oyster Bay and began to ascend the green slopes of Lee Home. Now, for the first time, he could admire his recently completed house. Huge, angular, and squat, it sat on the grassy hilltop with all the grace of a fort. Bammy's gardeners had planted vines, shrubs, and saplings in an effort to refine its silhouette, but years would pass before leaves mercifully screened most of the house from view. As Roosevelt drew nearer, its newness and rawness became more apparent. The mustard-colored shingles had not yet mellowed, and the green trim clashed with florid brick and garish displays of stained glass. However, flowers were clustering around the piazza, last year's lawns had come up thick and velvety, and spring rains had washed away the last traces of construction dirt. Roosevelt might be excused a surge of proprietary emotion. Looking south across the bay toward Tranquility, rented to others now, but still a symbol in its antebellum graciousness of Mitty, he could see the beach where dem web-butted Roosevelts used to run down to bathe, the private, reedy channels where he rode little Edie Carroll, the tidal waters where he and Elliot had once joyously battled a snowy nor'easter, and there, snaking west to the station, was the lane along which Theodore Sr. used to speed, his linen duster ballooning out behind him. At nearer points through the trees could be seen the summer houses of cousins and uncles and aunts. If there were some hillside walks and a tennis court or two that Roosevelt could not contemplate without being painfully reminded of his honeymoon, he had at last developed the strength to deal with elusive memories. In token of that strength, he decided that the name Lee Home must be changed. Henceforth, his house would commemorate the Indian Sagamore, or chieftain, who had held councils of war here 2.5 centuries before. He would call it Sagamore Hill. Roosevelt allowed himself 8 idyllic weeks in the East during the summer of 1885, his first period of relaxation in 2 years. Fanny Smith, now married to a Commander Dana and recovering from a miscarriage, was one of the many guests he invited to stay at Sagamore Hill. Although unable to take part in a frenetic schedule of outdoor activities, such as portaging across mosquito-infested mudflats and tumbling down Cooper's Bluff into the sea, she was able to enjoy the stimulating conversation at Bammy's dinner table. Especially memorable were the battles, ancient and modern, which were waged relentlessly on the white linen tablecloth with the aid of such table silver as was available. Theodore's penchant for military history made her feel that Hannibal lived just around the corner. The entire household went into New York on 8 August to watch General Grant's funeral parade. Roosevelt himself marched in his capacity as a captain in the National Guard. "I shall never forget the tense expression on his face as he passed with his regiment," wrote Fanny. "And it seemed to me that the bit of crepe that floated from his rifle was conspicuous for its size." Back at Sagamore Hill, Roosevelt indulged in many romps with little Alice, who was now a mass of yellow curls and just learning to walk. Occasionally, perhaps, he strolled through the trees to Gracewood, where Aunt Annie lived, to cuddle little Eleanor Roosevelt, his brother's 10-month-old daughter. On returning home, he could ponder the family motto carved in gold over the wide west door, "Qui plantavit, curabit." He who has planted will preserve. Roots were forming, fragile ones, exploratory as those of his saplings, yet sure to anchor him permanently someday. Right now his other roots out west seemed lustier and stronger. He was bound to return to his ranch and would, in time, inhabit many houses, including the grandest in the land. But sooner or later these roots would cause all others to wither, and he would come back more and more to Sagamore Hill. Here hung the hallowed portrait of his father and various stuffed symbols of his own manhood, the buffalo, the bears, the many antelope heads. The place was loud with the happy squeals of his daughter, the conversation of his friends and relatives. This endearingly ugly house was home. In it he would live out his 60 years, Roosevelt was already quite sure of that figure, and die. But for the time being, he was 26, and the Wild West was calling. Urging Bammy to continue her entertainments on his behalf, he caught the Chicago Limited out of New York on 22 August, 1885. Newspapermen were waiting to interview Roosevelt at St. Paul and Bismarck as usual, but for some reason they seemed more interested in talking about the Marquis de Moret than about politics. Was it true that he and the Marquis had recently had a slight tilt, and that their relations were somewhat strained? The only tilt Roosevelt could think of, and it was trivial in his opinion, was a business misunderstanding that had occurred during the spring. He had contracted to sell some cattle to the Northern Pacific Refrigerator Car Company at a price of 6 cents a pound, but on delivery, de Moret had reduced the price to 5.5 cents a pound, saying that the market in Chicago was down by that much. Roosevelt, in turn, had insisted that a contract was a contract, irrespective of price fluctuations afterward. But the Marquis remained obdurate. Roosevelt had philosophically taken his cattle back and let it be known that he would not do business with the Marquis again. Now, months later, he sought to play down the incident. It was not true, he said, that the two cattle kings of the Badlands were looking for each other with clubs. The story of a tilt was exaggerated. But why all these questions? He found out soon enough. The Marquis de Moret had just been indicted for murder. Roosevelt reached Medora on 25 August and paused only to announce a meeting of his Little Missouri Stockmen's Association on 5 September before hurrying north to discuss the indictment with Sewell and Dow. He already knew the facts. This murder was nothing new, merely another skirmish in the legal war that had been waged against de Moret ever since the fatal ambush of 26 June 1883. Charges that the Marquis had killed Riley Lufsey had twice been examined by justices of the peace and twice dismissed for lack of proof. Yet now a grand jury in Mandan had decided there was enough evidence to warrant a trial. De Moret, who had also been vacationing in the East, arrived in Dakota close on Roosevelt's heels and gave himself up to the authorities. They told him that a little matter of $1,500 judiciously distributed would cause the indictment to be withdrawn. "I have plenty of money for defense," he replied haughtily, "but not a dollar for blackmail." He was promptly placed in Bismarck jail. A subtly transformed ranch house greeted the returning proprietor of Elkhorn. There were unmistakable signs of feminine occupation. Patches of bright color in the windows, delicate items of laundry hanging up to dry, a new air of neatness and tidiness. Inside, Roosevelt found Mrs. Sewell and Mrs. Dow, along with Kitty Sewell, a forlorn little morsel, about the same age as Baby Lee. Dow had brought them all west 3 weeks before. Roosevelt was pleased to have more company under his roof. The ranch house was amply big enough for six, so big indeed that it needed domestic management. The women, in turn, were anxious to repay him for their free board and lodging. They swept and scrubbed and polished, mended his linen, and at regular intervals sorted out his possessions so he could find what he was looking for. Best of all, they fed him, not as elaborately as Bammy on the polished boards of Sagamore Hill, but from the nutritional point of view probably better. After a dusty morning's work on the range or in the corral, he would return ravenous to the Elkhorn table, on the clean cloth of which are spread platters of smoked elk meat, loaves of good bread, jugs and bowls of milk, saddles of venison or broiled antelope steaks, perhaps roast and fried prairie chickens with eggs, butter, wild plums, and tea or coffee. Sometimes there were potatoes coaxed from the harsh alkaline soil, jars of buffalo berry jam, dishes of jelly and cake. Roosevelt's appetite had grown prodigious since his physical transformation in the spring, and he gobbled everything greedily. No doubt he continued to put on weight, but the hard exercise of ranch life kept him, in Bill Sewell's words, clear bone, muscle, and grit. Grit of another sort was called for on 5 September, when Roosevelt, who had gone to Medora to chair the Stockmen's Association meeting, received the following letter from a jail cell in Bismarck. "My dear Roosevelt, my principle is to take the bull by the horns. Joe Ferris is very active against me and has been instrumental in getting me indicted by furnishing money to witnesses and hunting them up. The papers also published very stupid accounts of our quarreling. Is this done by your order? I thought you my friend. If you are my enemy, I want to know it. I am always on hand, as you know, and between gentlemen, It is easy to settle matters of that sort directly. Yours very truly, Moret. September 3, 1885. Roosevelt's first reaction must have been bewilderment. Despite their little skirmishes over beef prices and grazing rights, he and the Marquis got on fairly well. They had entertained each other at lunch, exchanged books and newspapers, and there had even been an occasion, during a square dance in honor of the spring roundup, when they solemnly took the floor together and do-si-do'd with cowgirls. Yet there was no mistaking the threatening tone of this letter. He could not have read it without a pang of real fear. The Marquis was known to have killed at least 2 men in duels, and his feats of marksmanship, such as picking off prairie chickens on the wing with a 20-30 Winchester, were legendary. If this letter was, as it seemed, a challenge to arms, Roosevelt would have the choice of weapons. But that was of small comfort to a myopic individual who claimed to be not more than an ordinary shot. The Marquis's trial was already underway, and if acquitted, he might demand satisfaction at once. Before replying, it was necessary to clarify the Frenchman's cloudy umbrage. He obviously believed that Joe Ferris, Roosevelt's old buffalo guide, was bribing witnesses, and with Roosevelt's money. Joe was now a storekeeper in Medora, but he also acted as the unofficial banker of the Badlands. Cowboys would deposit their earnings with him for safekeeping and withdraw cash from time to time, when they had to go to Bismarck to testify at a murder trial, for instance. The Marquis must be unaware of this. All he did know was that Roosevelt had financed Joe's store, and therefore suspected that the same person might well be financing his prosecution. De Moret also complained about articles publicizing the so-called tilt. These rumors had been put out by reporters who regularly interviewed Roosevelt at railroad stations farther east. Conceivably, he could have leaked the stories on his latest trip to New York, knowing that by the time he returned to deny them, they would be accepted as fact. The last and most damaging proof of ill will, as far as De Moret was concerned, was that one of the men to receive money from Joe Ferris before the trial was Dutch Wanigan, a victim of the original ambush, a key prosecution witness, and for the past year or more, an employee of Theodore Roosevelt. All these misconceptions might surely be explained away, but how could De Moret ever have imagined that the most decent man in the Badlands was plotting his destruction? Roosevelt, staring dumbfounded at the letter in his hand, knew the notion was preposterous. He discussed his options with Sewell and said that he was opposed to dueling on principle. But he could not ignore such a challenge. He must answer De Moret in kind. "I won't be bullied by a Frenchman. What do you say if I make it rifles?" Sitting down on a log and flipping the letter over, he scrawled on its back the draft of his reply. "Medora, Dakota, September 6, 1885. Most emphatically, I am not your enemy. If I were, you would know it, for I would be an open one, and would not have asked you to my house nor gone to yours. As your final words, however, seem to imply a threat, it is due to myself to say that the statement is not made through any fear of possible consequences to me. I, too, as you know, am always on hand, and ever ready to hold myself accountable in any way for anything I have said or done. Yours very truly, Theodore Roosevelt." Sewell agreed to act as second, while doubting that the duel would ever take place. "He'll find some way out of it." A few days later, a courier arrived with another message from the Marquis. Roosevelt showed it to Sewell. "You were right, Bill." De Moret protested that he had implied no threat in his previous letter. He meant, simply, that there was always a way to settle misunderstandings between gentlemen without trouble. The tone of this letter was sufficiently conciliatory for Roosevelt to boast later that the Marquis had apologized. And so the epic confrontation fizzled out, disappointingly for those like E.G. Paddock, who had hoped for violence, but decisively in Roosevelt's favor nonetheless. From then on, progress toward organization was rapid in Billings County. Newspapers began to speak of Roosevelt as the likely first senator from Dakota, when the territory was elevated to statehood. Autumn came early to the Badlands, but the cooling air did not prevent the sun from burning every last drop of green juice out of the grass. The prairie became a brittle carpet underfoot, wanting only the spark of a horseshoe on stone, or a tumbling ember of lignite, to erupt into flame. Several times that September, Roosevelt found himself fighting fires on his own range. Similar fires were reported all over Billings County. Stockmen plotted their various locations and grew increasingly suspicious. All the outbreaks were in the Drive Country, a broad strip of grassland lying between the Northern Pacific Railroad and the cattle ranches on either side. This strip, 50 miles wide and hundreds of miles long, had to be crossed by any herd en route to shipping points like Mingus